Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
You'll never go till you move. You'll never go till you move. You'll never go until you move.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mark Curry? Y'all like Mark? Little Rock's Mark Curry is a singer-songwriter whose roots run through Fort Worth, Texas, and the deep pine forest of southeast Arkansas. More can be heard at markcurry.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has opened up for late blues artist Lonnie Fitchford at the Sunflower Blues Festival in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and our featured artist tonight is Arkansas painter Jason Meredith. And our featured piece is this small piece here entitled The Hands That Feed, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Jason at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all find our writers in, let's say, awkward situations. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Larry Taylor's daughter talks him into something he later may not be able to get out of. And we'll end the night with John Wells as he tries to execute his exit strategy before he is discovered. But let's start the night with Jenny Carlisle as she stumbles into the limelight in Whistling in Public Places.
On that day in 1990, a good 11 years before 9/11 added metal detectors and extra security, I entered the south door of the Arkansas State Capitol building like I'd done 1,000 times before. The halls were dark and rather quiet as I passed a sign that always made me laugh, private senators only. Weren't all senators actually public employees? How did one go about obtaining their own private senator? I continued past empty committee rooms and portraits of past Supreme Court justices, past the wide marble staircase, and slowed slightly to peer into the glass cases on either side of a slightly narrower passage. Recognizing the photos and labels from a previous visit, I continued into the great rotunda. By the time I turned right toward the post office, I was whistling happily. A very bright light confronted and momentarily blinded me, and I stopped just before plowing into the back of a tall figure in a gray suit. I bobbed to the left and almost tripped over a man who was shoving a microphone toward the suit. "What is your comment about that, Governor Clinton?" One perk of being a career State of Arkansas employee was working within walking distance of our beautiful Capitol building. Visitors from other states are jealous of the meticulous landscaping and the magnificent structure itself, which is a smaller replica of the U.S. Capitol. Inside, the cool marble halls and always interesting exhibits appeal to my love of history and great architecture. Our children have inherited my love for the grand old lady. One of our favorite traditions when they were growing up was an after-dinner visit on Christmas Day, where we enjoyed the outdoor lights and the simple but elegant indoor decor. All three have served as legislative pages, which made them familiar with the behind-the-scenes secrets, like hidden stairways and the locations of all the copy machines. The oldest son probably still counts as his favorite job of all time, his stint as a tour guide. I accompanied him once and beamed proudly as he shared the oft-repeated stories of the construction of the building and the daily functions of our seat of government. One tourist from Oklahoma stopped progress for a moment in front of two adjacent office doors. "Now I know why it takes so long to get things done." We all laughed as he snapped a photo of the proudly emblazoned names of our senators, Argue and Delay. The same group stood spellbound on the first floor, gazing up at the dome. They told us that their capital was not graced with this beautiful feature. I think that that problem has since been remedied. During the more than 20 years that I was located across 7th Street, I became very comfortable in and around this local landmark. A lap or two around the oval walkways below the building on the west side made for a perfect exercise break. If I couldn't come up with an official errand to run, I would often spend lunch hours doing business at the post office, shopping in the gift shop, or cashing a check in the state treasurer's office. Best of all, the basement housed a cafeteria with good old Arkansas cooking, which attracted a veritable who's who of movers and shakers, both during and between legislative sessions. More than just a building near where I worked, I felt at home in my state capital. Perhaps this comfort level caused me to almost fall face first into the man who would one day become the 42nd President of the United States. Someone grasped my elbow to steady me, and I turned to see those famous laughing eyes. The tune I'd been whistling was quickly swallowed. I smiled back and slid past the reporter toward the safety of the elevator. Thankfully, the door opened shortly after I punched the down arrow, and I jumped inside, grateful for the heavy door that shielded me from the paparazzi. I comforted myself with the fact that I would never have occasion to be that close to our governor again. Hopefully, a clever editor at the television station would be able to remove all evidence of my intrusion. I perused the menu that was posted outside the cafeteria and continued to the cart that held the plastic trays and the real silverware that I would need for my meal. Should I start with a salad today or end with a dish of banana pudding? The employees behind the counter were helpful as always, and I reached to retrieve a bowl of turnip greens across the sneeze guard. Strangely, the lady holding that bowl seemed to be more concerned with the patron who was in line behind me. Okay, you're already ahead of me. Of course, it was himself. He had successfully disposed of the media and was now placing chicken fried steak, mashed potatoes, and gravy on his tray. He was definitely not a vegan in those pre-hard issue Arkansas days. "I'm so sorry," I cleared my throat and looked in his direction. "Please forgive my interruption a moment ago." He laughed. "Oh, don't worry about it. That was a whole lot more fun than what those guys wanted to talk about." A kind pat on the shoulder reinforced his sincerity. I paid for my food, found an empty table while he lingered at the cash register, chatting amiably with the lady who most likely informed him his meal was on the house. Thankfully, he and his always present entourage strode past me on the way to a private dining room in the back. If only the story ended there. The one thing I didn't count on was that along with having a talent for putting folks at ease, this governor possessed a photographic memory. Once he'd met you, he could recall the where and how of your first meeting forever. So each time after that day, when we'd pass those hallowed halls, there would be that smile, that chuckle, that pointed finger, reminding me that he still remembered my less than graceful press conference debut. On the odd chance that I might run into our now former president in his triple-wide museum on the river, maybe I should wear dark glasses on my next visit, or at the very least, I should heed the voices of my mother and grandmother who cautioned me that a lady never whistles in public places.
Jenny Carlisle retired with 35 years of service to the state of Arkansas and now trains claims examiners for Transamerica Employee Benefits. A columnist for Ouachita Life magazine, she vows to be a Christian fiction author when she grows up. Next, Larry Taylor's awkward situation starts with a simple request from his daughter in Big Guys and Roller Coasters.
As my 8-year-old daughter and I stood in line with the other devoted faithful, the roaring of the Batman roller coaster overhead, I noticed a sign that stated, "If you had a heart condition, this ride might not be for you." Not a small man, I shifted my 250-pound frame from one foot to the other. A little later, while weaving through the gates, I saw another sign. "This ride has 3 outside loops, 2 inside loops, and speeds up to 60 miles an hour, lasting approximately 2 minutes. This sign brought the first sign into perfect clarity. When my daughter read the sign, I knew we were committed. It was a cloudy Thursday when we had ventured out to Six Flags over Georgia while in Atlanta visiting family. After purchasing our tickets and entering the park, our oldest daughter, who had been talking nonstop about roller coasters ever since we mentioned the possibility of going to the theme park, she raced ahead of us, furiously scoping out all the rides. She was tall for her age, so she got to ride the good rides. Long had it been since the days of merry-go-rounds and Ferris wheels. "Those are for kids," she would tell you. "Bigger, better, faster" was always her goal. Suddenly, she stopped, dead in her tracks. It was as though the clouds had parted and a single ray of sunlight shone upon her face while angels sang in the background. Before her was the Batman roller coaster ride. Now, my wife does not enjoy roller coasters or any other amusement park ride, so by default, I became the designated ride buddy. My daughter eagerly tugged at my arm when we got in line. After what probably seemed like an eternity for my daughter and an all too brief moment for me, the time came for us to board the Batman ride. For those unfamiliar with this ride, it is an inverted roller coaster where the rails are overhead and the seats set down below it like a ski lift. Once seated, a metal harness is pulled down over your shoulders and connects to a strap with a seatbelt connector in front of the seat. After getting my daughter all strapped up, she grabbed the harness with both hands, looking straight ahead, and even appeared to stop blinking. She was ready. I climbed onto my seat, reached up, pulled down the harness, and I pulled the strap to connect the buckle below. It stopped. It was about 2 inches too short. I pressed the harness against my chest and exhaled every last bit of oxygen I had in my lungs. Straining and probably blue from the lack of oxygen, the strap would not connect to the buckle. I began to think about my options. Maybe I could just hold on to the harness for 2 minutes. Maybe I could hold on to the strap between my knees and rodeo my way through the ride. While I was pondering my options, a freckle-faced 160-pound teenager, probably working his way through school, came over and said, "Sir, you must connect the harness to the buckle for the ride to continue." "I know, son, I am trying," I replied. With that, he grabbed the harness and began to push as I exhaled in a rhythm like some bizarre Lamaze session. I began to come to terms with the idea that this ride was not for me. Then the young man yelled, "Hey, Bob!" Unlike his counterpart, Bob was 6'4". His shirt looked like a sack of bowling balls. He sauntered over, grabbed the harness, and with his face about 2 inches from mine, nodded and said, "Just relax." Chung! Click, 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 snap. Now that snap caught my attention. I was sure that was the sound of my spine being forced through my chest. As I looked down, I did not see my spine, but I saw something even more amazing. The strap that 2 men earlier could not connect was now connected, and there was slack. I was now mounted in this chair. With the harness buried deep into my chest, my arms being forced out away from my body, I began to wonder how I was going to hold on since my arms could not easily grasp the harness. Then it occurred to me, this ride could blow apart, and while I'm not sure where they'd find me, I knew I would still be in this chair. The ride began with an acceleration that previously only naval aviators experienced during carrier takeoffs. The Batman roller coaster went up and around the loops with my daughter screaming, still not blinking. The other riders screaming, and the best I could do was a high-pitched whistle. After 2 minutes, the ride mercifully came to an end. I clicked the belt buckle and released the strap with the air rushing into my lungs. As we got out of the seats, I began taking deep breaths again. My daughter stood for a moment, looking at me in wide-eyed amazement. Then she bolted down the ramp toward Mom. Popping into shape and catching up to them, I could hear her telling Mom, "You should have seen Dad. He didn't scream, he didn't even hold on." My bones were still cracking as I put my arm around my daughter and said, "Well, that's just the kind of dad you have, sweetheart." Things were going well for a moment until she said, "Let's do that one again."
Larry Taylor is a computer software developer in the Little Rock area and has been programming for almost 30 years. He enjoys listening and sharing stories with family and friends. In our final story of the night, John Wells' guard is down as he enters the room, and it all goes downhill from there in Four Heroes.
I remember thinking that Tony had lost his ever-loving mind. Out of nowhere, he seemed hell-bent on discussing the intricacies of farm management. Note that neither Tony nor I work the land. Quite the opposite, we are city slickers, employed by a large government bureaucracy. So for the life of me, I was at a loss to understand why he picked this time and place to broach such a topic. It was otherwise a normal day. As usual, I arrived at work, headed for the director's office, and settled in at the conference table for the morning briefing. The room was filled with high-ranking muckety-mucks, chatting it up as the meeting was about to start. Many of us wore red, as it was wear red to end Cooties Day or something like that. Tony, also wearing red, was seated directly across the table. He droned on and on about the efficient use of farm resources. I tried to ignore him, but he seemed oddly intent on perpetuating this rather bizarre and, quite frankly, boring conversation. It was not my job to triage this man, but triage him I did. I am a mental health professional, you know. Instinctively, I went through my checklist. His eyes were clear. His pupils undilated, his affect and speech were normal, his breath was free of alcohol. Suddenly it hit me. He was speaking in code. Upon decryption, I realized that the outcome of this meeting, and quite possibly my career, hinged on the encrypted information I was now deciphering. At that moment, as an American, as a bureaucrat, and as a grateful citizen of the cosmos, I was proud to be seated across the table from this font of husbandry. Tony's behavior reminded me of a day when I was the one who appeared to be drunk. Sitting at my desk, minding my own business, the room began to spin like I'd just stepped off a tilt-a-whirl. I stumbled down the hall for an impromptu exchange with Karen, the advanced practice nurse. It was not her job to triage me, much less to drive me to my doctor, nor to hold my head out of the toilet as we waited. She even accompanied me into the exam room and briefed the doctor on my symptoms. The doc quickly surmised that I had a viral inner ear infection and sternly warned me to stay off work for a week. He then told me there were meds to take away the spins, but that the virus had to run its course. He stressed again that I was contagious and implored that I should stay home for a week. Are you going to do what I told you? With my head at full spin, I replied, "Doc, I got a federal job and a witness. What do you think I'm going to do?" There are many folks at our agency who always seem willing to do the next right thing, folks who understand the mission and do their part to see it through. Apparently, this hadn't always been the case. I have a drinking buddy, a Vietnam veteran named Johnny. Many a day on our respective bar stools, he's cursed my employer and derided his treatment from when he returned from the war. It was all I could do to convince him to give us another try. An organization can change in 40 years, you know. I knew immediately the first person he'd meet would be my friend Gertie. I first met Gertie almost 2 decades prior when it was my duty to outreach the homeless. It's very difficult to verify whether those folks were qualified for my services. Homeless people don't always keep their important records at their fingertips. That inconvenience ended the first time I got Gertie on the phone. I quickly learned that you could do official process A, official process B, or you could just call Gertie. She was and is a great asset to our organization. So Johnny arrives at the agency for the first time since the 70s, and I take him straight to her office. She stands, extends her hand, and flashes that million-dollar smile I'd seen a million times before. Her gesture for a handshake was Johnny's first glance at the little finger he would soon be wrapped around. Now, when I say a million-dollar smile, I'm not describing the work of a million-dollar dentist, but instead a rather ordinary set of teeth set inside a rather ordinary head of an extraordinary African-American woman, one who is so warm and caring that it wouldn't matter if she wore dentures. When she smiles, you can feel it. Like me, Gertie is no spring chicken. We are both survivors of a half century of life. She is not some young, skinny little sugar britches with a compelling beauty that no man can resist. But Gertie is seriously cute, and she can charm the socks off the crustiest of veterans. The next time I saw Johnny's wife, she gave me a big hug. She was grateful for Gertie and grateful to know that the quality medical care that her husband had earned in Vietnam would now be assured for the rest of his life, important now that he's retired. She then said something that you might think was odd. "Am I to understand I'm supposed to rub on your bald head?" What people don't know about Gertie is she has a thing for bald men. And after all she's done for me, our clients, and the country, it would be selfish of me not to indulge her in an occasional noggin rub. When I meet her coming down the hall, I always pause and tilt for a moment. So Mrs. Johnny began to rub on my head. "How am I doing?" That's not the way Gertie does it. What's the difference? Well, first, slow down. Slower. Slower. Now bigger circles. Now say, oh, Lord Jesus. That's the way Gertie does it. So fast forward to that beautiful spring morning a few weeks ago. On those Fridays when we dress to show support, I am all in. On this occasion, I even accessorized with red underwear. Now that's what I call support. I completed this ensemble by sporting a lovely black suit. This would be no casual Friday. Nope. This would be my day to make a statement. I was certainly dressed far too elegantly to be discussing farm data with Tony. Until I realized his message was encrypted. He was trying to tell me my pants were unzipped. In my effort to make a statement, I overshot the mark. Let me tell you, if you want to do something memorable, enter an executive level meeting in a black suit, red shirt, sporting a fashionably open zipper with red underwear. Nothing says, yoo-hoo, down here. Like a red diva peeking out a black curtain. I quickly scooted all the way under the table and strategized my exit. Problematic because the dignitaries were still entering the room. It became apparent that I'd have to quell the soprano in place. Tony, create a diversion. There was a chilling pause. Now, while Tony and I are on friendly terms, we are also verbal sparring partners. Tony is a stand-up guy, all about professionalism and dignity, and he's got a great sense of humor, which is a good thing because as a result of his efforts to maintain a professional demeanor, he is quite vulnerable to jokesters like me, and I often take advantage of the same. But now I was the one who was vulnerable, and the table had turned so fast I could feel the spins returning. In those excruciating seconds, I thought back to the day in that very room wherein I recalled to the group that I'd seen Tony the day before at the grocery store in his biking shorts. He was so cute. He looked like a real biker. I said that in front of all the muckety mucks, including his supervisor. I'm thinking, please God, don't remember that day. Please, God, don't say it's not my job. Please be a Karen. Please be a Gertie. He could have exacted revenge in the sweetest of ways. Instead, for me, for my red Cure the Cutie soprano, and for the good of the country, my now best friend Tony came through. After several excruciating seconds of blank stare, this pillar of professionalism slowly rotated his chair away from the table and inexplicably slammed his pad of paper to the floor. It landed perfectly flat with a loud smack. He calmly picked it up and rotated back to his previous position at the table. Every eye in the room was fixed on Tony in this inexplicable behavior. He never acknowledged their stares, proceeded as if nothing had happened. But something had happened. My dignity had been spared. The barn door had been closed. And the curtain was now drawn on the opera that never happened. All of which with no injury to the diva now safely inside.
A native of Little Rock is an avid craft beer advocate, critic, and educator. He entertains, writes, and lectures on fine beer through johnthebeersnob.com and via Facebook under the name John the Beer Snob. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Through my work, I had to run an errand with an attractive young blonde. She asked me how old I was, and I told her. And she said, "Wow, you're older than my dad." So shortly after that, I wrote this song. It's called Midlife Crisis.
Well, now maybe it's a midlife crisis, but it's all on the table now. Well, maybe I'm just tired of trying. Well, maybe I just don't know how. Get through all this hard depression. Well, the winner of my life is in view. So maybe I'll just sit by the fire and open up another bottle with you. Well, now maybe what I'm feeling is special. Maybe just the way that it goes. Well, everybody's trying to help me, but I'm kind of thinking nobody knows how I'm gonna sort through all these friends and relations who are waiting at the end of the phone. Well, there ain't nobody wants to be lonely, though, but I wish that they would leave me alone. You see, I'm in between the coming in and the getting out. Take me more than a minute just to figure out what I'm gonna do. So maybe, honey, while I'm waiting, I'll have a midlife crisis with you. Yes, I'm in the middle of the nowhere. before the song is through. So come on over, honey, and snuggle. Yeah, maybe you can have a crisis too. I said just come on over, honey, and let's snuggle.
Brighter accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.